Hi, welcome back to Climate Queens and our special summer series. So for the next three episodes, we'll be partnering with an amazing NGO called Frontline Defenders. And as you all know, as you're listening at this point, we are pretty passionate about climate change and climate activism. And when we think of climate activism, we don't always think of those who face personal risks working to protect the environment. In some countries, human rights defenders are advocating for action on the climate, and they can be threatened, harassed, and detained for their peaceful work. So we especially wanted to highlight those who are directly impacted by the climate crisis in this way, not think of a better organization to partner with than Frontline Defenders.
Yes, so Frontline Defenders is an Ireland-based international human rights organisation with the specific aim of protecting human rights defenders, or HRDs, at risk. Over the next few months, we'll be speaking to three human rights defenders from different countries, discussing their stories and bringing you their experience on the front lines.
Today, we will be speaking to an incredible frontline defender, Joseph Rahal from Sierra Leone. But before we jump into our conversation with Joseph, we are delighted to firstly introduce you all to Mariam Sawadigo. Mariam is the Frontline Defender Regional Protection Coordinator for the continent of Africa. Mariam, welcome to Climate Queens. Hello.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Queens.
Thank you.
We'll take Queens.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Mariam. And obviously, before we speak to Joseph, would you like to share a bit about Joseph's background and the work that he does?
Joseph Rahal is an expert in environmental protection with over 27 years' experience. In 1989, when Joseph was still a high school teacher, he founded Green Scenery, an organization that works to promote environmental awareness and ensure the conservation of Sierra Leone, as well as setting up this incredible organization. Joseph also played a key role in establishing organizations such as the National Forum for Human Rights and the National League for Human Rights. Joseph has worked as a journalist and as an editor of a newspaper. He also has served in various voluntary capacities in organizations like the Sierra Leone Adult Education Association and the Sierra Leone Association of Journalists. Joseph has used his expertise and on several projects and undertaken a number of studies, writing extensively on the environment, including a notable contribution to the 2012 Global Hunger Index, named The Challenge of Hunger, Ensuring Sustainable Food Security Under Land, Water and Energy Stress.
Mariam, thank you so much for that, and especially for joining us and speaking with us. And before we chat with Joseph, I think it's safe to say that, including yourself, but Joseph's CV would put us all to shame. So we are absolutely honoured to have him join us today. Joseph, hello and welcome to Climate Queens.
Hello. Oh,
hello.
Yeah. Pretty. Lodag and Mariam, thank you so much for bringing me on board the Climate Queens program.
You are absolutely so welcome, and you're an honorary queen for the next 40 minutes.
Wow. I'm honored.
Joseph, before we delve into your incredible journey and, you know, the many injustices that surround Sierra Leone, in particular the climate crisis, could you tell us about where you grew up and the changes that you've seen in your community from both a biodiversity and environmental perspective?
I was born in the 60s, 1960, and I grew up right up into Bond. I grew up right through 1970s and then came into Freetown as a youth away in the 70s, and then went to college around the same time, did my sixth form, and I went to college. So I left the university in 1988, exactly with my first degree. And after that, I came to Freetown and started work as a school teacher. So that's how this whole thing of my experience with Banff and Freetown, with the current conditions that are there, and they are monumental, eh? They are really monumental. The sea level rise in Banff or the island, and the deforestation, the rate of deforestation in Freetown is so huge that even the government is finding it so difficult to control. The additional part of it is that the climate becomes, or the weather becomes so freaky. There'll come a time when it will not rain on time. A couple of years ago, everybody expected rain. It did not rain. When the farmers had to start their farming, they were waiting for the rain to put in, after they have put in their crops, their seeds and everything. It did not rain. After 3-4 months, everything perished. So you are not able to determine when it will rain or how much rain will come, you know, the volume of rain that will really come. And if that volume comes, how much impact it will create, you know, on the farmland. It might flood. It might be so small that the crops will not, you know, do well. So you have these problems. But of course, the climate change issues also lead to things like flooding and landslides and stuff like that. Recently, in 2017, we had that experience in Freetown where the land just break off. And there was this big mass of earth. Many people called it a mudslide, but it was really a landslide. And that impacts on food production because all of that debris ended up into the ocean. And when it gets into the ocean, there's going to be huge mass of decoloration of the ocean, and the fishes are going to suffer because they are going to start to take sediments into their gills, and they are going to move away. And those who live by the sea to survive in terms of their livelihoods will start to go deeper into the seas to look for the fishes. And that's where they might end up getting accidents or drowning will take place. So you see how the interconnectedness it is with climate change, food production.
So obviously you're seeing all this land devastation and the impact of the climate crisis firsthand. Is that how you became involved in fighting against these many injustices that are facing Sierra Leone?
Yes, we saw that fighting these causes are very important because there are so many people out there who are not able to speak for themselves, thousands, maybe even millions of them. And if, for instance, I was at a point put behind bars because I was vocal in my newspaper, I thought to myself, I mean, imagine being a writer, maybe not a powerful writer, but a writer and who has been writing and trying to convince government authorities, I could be put behind bars for just advocating for something. Then there is really a big problem, especially for those people who are not educated, who cannot write, who cannot think through the issues, who have practically no voice. And those were the moments that I told myself, you need to take a course. And that course I've taken since then.
And could you tell us then how you came to find Green Scenery from and this type of work? And I mean, you're explaining why it's so important, but who are you hoping to impact with the work you're doing with Green Scenery?
Well, at the time, because we were in the classroom, I convinced my colleagues, and I got a number of them to join me. And so we established initially what we called Project Green Scenery. And it was a project for us because we really did not know how to manage projects, how to manage organizations. So we started to learn from the project perspective. But we then told ourselves that the best target will be our children. I mean, the students or the pupils we are teaching could be our first line of clientele, so to speak. So we use that as we use the children as our first target to bring in environmental education to them. And the adage at that time was catch them young, because we knew that if you catch them young, you can change a whole lot of things inside a child. And I will tell you for free, those children we had, now they are all adults, those children we had many years ago as environmental clubs, in the environmental clubs, you will not believe, when we meet, we still talk about environmental issues. So we were able to drop the culture of thinking environment at that level, you know. So those were our first targets. But then after a while we said, okay, well, we will put programs into the school and see how the schools can react to it and find a way of getting government to own the whole issue of environmental education in schools. We were not able to succeed in the aspect of getting environmental education in schools as a standalone project, I mean, as a standalone subject, but we were able to convince government to integrate environmental issues into particular subject areas. And we were able to do that. And so even up to now, you have a lot of environmental issues sitting in social studies, for instance. But we were really hoping that we'll get the subject alone, because it touches on everything we live for. It touches on our lives, touches on everything on earth. But our government did not see it that way at that time. Given that, and today, I will say that almost every part of Sierra Leone have actually felt our work. If it is not on the issue of the extractives, it is on the issue of farmland, it is on the issue of deforestation, it is on the issue of land degradation, or human rights, as the case may be.
Yes. And Joseph, it really seems that green scenery is at the cross section of so many key and important issues. And you also mentioned just how so many disciplines are interconnected. And I think I'm sure you'll agree that there are many similarities between the inequalities embedded in this current pandemic that we're facing and the climate crisis. I actually joined a webinar yesterday where our former President of Ireland, Mary Robinson, and South African environmental activist Kumi Naidu, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, they were both speaking. And Mary Robinson referred to this pandemic as a mirror, and that it's reflecting the injustices and, you know, inequalities that are so deeply rooted in our world today, and that we specifically see not only with, you know, the current pandemic, but also with many developing countries, it's experiencing the worst effects of the climate crisis. Would you mind sharing with us your thoughts on this and perhaps explaining to our listeners what issues local communities in Sierra Leone are experiencing as a direct result of the changing climate, and maybe what solutions you're seeing on the ground as well?
Well, you called Mary Robinson, and I really would give my heart to her, because she was very brave enough to come to Sierra Leone at a time when our country was one of the deepest form of war. She came here, and I was very lucky to have met her. So I give my heart to her, because she's still a very strong person in the human rights world. Given the situation that our countries have very, very poor facilities for health, very, very poor facilities for farming, poor facilities in terms of socioeconomic development, and even the economy, you will now see that our governments are spending so much money trying to deal with the pandemic and forgetting the other sectors. For instance, food production. How much investment can be made in the food production sector when there's need for money to be spent on health, you know? So poor people around the world, and particularly in our own case in Sierra Leone, are suffering gravely, because before the pandemic, they were already in a very grave situation where poverty is very high. You know it. We are like one of the countries really at the bottom of the Human Development Index. You will see that poverty has just been excruciated by the current pandemic, because our people are so afraid of wanting to move around, especially when you have government policies and regulations and restrictions. Sometimes they are so afraid because of hunger, they have to move out in a very, very brave way to defeat what you call the pangs of hunger. I remember when just before our lockdowns in Sierra Leone, when the country declared its first case, we were very quick to go into our communities where we work, to inform them about the graveness of the disease and to prepare them and their mindset about what is to come. In those meetings we held, they were so worried and concerned. Of course, they equated it to the Ebola incident that we had in 2013, 14, 15, I think. So you will see that in the case of the COVID, our country is spending so much money on the health sector to the extent that other sectors are suffering. And when those other sectors suffer, it is us common people who are going to face the brunt of all of this. So you see how the interconnectedness it is with climate change food production. On the land, you have this dilemma. In the sea, you have also this dilemma. And we waste so much product, plastic waste, and these all end up into the sea, and they have impact on sea life. So the connections are so great that if you don't deal with one thing, you know, many other things are going to be affected. I mean, we thought that deforestation, I mean, the trees are always there. I mean, they will grow again. But now, only 3% of the forest cover is left in Sierra Leone. Can you imagine that? We used to have 60-70% of forest cover. Now we only have 3%.
Wow.
Because of our propensity of thinking that it's always there, nature is there, we have abundant rain, which we are not harvesting, you know, and we are losing out on that. We don't get the required rainwater that we need to give us water in our homes, because the deforestation in the water catchment areas are so grave that water is not now seeping into the earth that should stay there and come back to us as surface water or other forms of potable water.
I suppose one particular thing that we'd like to kind of get your opinion on is, you know, you mentioned kind of business as usual. And, you know, I suppose we know that we need to move away from this, you know, quote unquote, capitalistic model that we're currently in, that is completely unsustainable for all of us living on this planet. We essentially need to redefine our relationship with consumption and how we treat our planet. I suppose what we want to kind of get your thoughts on is, you know, given that this is such a huge task, you know, where do you find your hope and motivation to keep fighting for what you fight for in terms of peace and climate justice for everyone?
It is a big dilemma for us sometimes when we sit down in the office and trying to chat out what exactly, where do we start? I mean, if we're taking an advocacy angle, where do we start? How do we move around it? Because you will see that the consumption pattern around the world, and especially in the north, is driving so much propensity for land in the south. The footprints of northern countries, their demand for food, their demand for natural resources is such a huge thing that northern countries, investors from northern countries, have practically exhausted what is in those countries, and they now have to look for greener areas where they can come and invest their businesses. And that one affects directly the locals that they meet. One, they come with a different culture, different understanding. They come with different perspective entirely about management, you know, how to do business, completely different. There is profit and profit at all costs. And so it goes against the grains of local producers, wherein local producers think culturally, they think traditionally, they think communally, you know, as a unit. But when an investor comes into a community, into a region, all of that changes because the transformation is so huge. When they are bringing in their business, it becomes madness, entire madness for local people. Their understanding of it is so difficult. And they see the investors as bullies who want to come and just take over their resources. And that's where the conflict comes in. And the governments, because they have to side the investors, come in with heavy-handedness, with police or military brutalities, and problems of serious conflict comes in, violence comes in, and big-time human rights violations set in, including the rights to life, including the rights to freedom of movement, curfews and stuff like that. So you see that the northern model of business and the southern model, I mean, especially in agriculture, are quite poles apart. Whilst we are thinking of family farmers who are supposed to be the producers, who think properly through ecological systems that will not devastate their farmlands, the northern farmer comes in, takes everything off the land, plows it, puts what they want, monoculture, and they are in. Fertilizers, insecticides, and you name it. At the end, it affects the country's ecology, it affects the life of people, it affects their health, it affects even their farming patterns and farm and way of life. So you see that they are completely different thing.
And Joseph, do you find, you know, your hope and motivation through, you know, empowering local communities in that way? You know, how do you motivate yourself to keep going? Because, you know, it's obviously, it's a very difficult task.
It is. I mean, it is a very difficult task. Not less to say that the challenges are sometimes so huge that you are really faced with many problems. For instance, I mean, just working or monitoring a particular business entity in the country around these issues of land grabs, around the issues of violations, we are being seen as the devil, and we are being seen as those people who do not want development. That translates into propagation with government, and government do not see us as partners that they should work with, so to speak, in areas of that nature. So you will see that on one side, the government might not be comfortable with you because you are bringing out the truth and asking them to do due diligence, asking them to do the needful. You're also telling companies that you guys are international. You guys have a lot of knowledge. You guys have plenty of expertise. You can go all over the world and look at all of the treaties and see all of these and bring them to bear on your business model and your business activity to the point that it will not hurt local communities. No, it's not done that way. So the challenges we face is this. To a point, our government do not see us as good friends. The companies do not see us as good friends. The communities, they want to work with us. We are like the saviors. I'm sorry, I don't like using that word. I'm not a savior. But we are like people who are speaking for them. And so they want to work with us. So what we do now is, one, try to work with communities, empower them to ask their own questions on their own, help them in the ways that we can support in terms of initiatives that will keep their lives going, finding alternative ways of living in a situation where it is so difficult to change the paradigm in their current situations.
Joseph, it really sounds like you are providing a lot of hope for your communities. And I'm just wondering there, you were mentioning about, you know, different heavy-handedness, like as an environmental and human rights defender yourself, you know, have you, your friends or your family ever felt threatened or in danger? And could you explain your experience maybe and how this might have impacted your work?
Well, I have lived with threats many times. Even though I can take them very seriously, I try my best so that it doesn't greatly impact my performance with my work. Since we started the work on land, when we took land as an issue, we knew it was going to be a real problem, because land issues are very conflictual and they are also political. And so we assessed, personally, I assessed the situation, and I knew that this was where we were going to go. It might come easy or it might come difficult. Either way, we have to go and we have to do the work. So you will see that transcending these options, when you have to look at the two sides fighting you, a small organization, for instance, being taken to court, being written all over newspapers as a person who is not contributing to government policies, an organization that do not want investors, an organization that is against employment. You know, those things that will sink into government mind and just make government hate you, hate your organization. And these are the threats. And sometimes it is so much, it comes in leaps and bounces, to the extent that you see it in three newspapers at one go, the same story or perhaps different stories, and these are all lies. They are all lies. But these are the powerful guys who can pay for those publications, who are threatening you to stop the work you do. So yes, we have been threatened many times. There are times when I come to the office, I see my colleagues, they are in a remorseful situation, condition. They are not happy, you know. But I try to change the face of the office by just being happy and telling them that, I mean, this is not the end of the world. I mean, we're going to get over it and we continue doing our work. I mean, if I was not a brave person leading my team, maybe we could have shut down Green Scenery, you know. But yes, those challenges are there, and our colleagues, also face the same thing. I mean, we have been threatened by even the highest authority in the land in 2017, when the former president went to launch the one of the company's oil mill, where they announced publicly that anybody who touches this company was touching me. I mean, that means the president. That was the biggest threat anybody can face. We felt so threatened. I mean, we've been rejected from entering communities. Even now, we want to go there into the communities that we work with. We are prevented from going in to work with our communities. These are all threats. They are vile, they are alive. But yet still, we don't give up hope. And we don't tell those guys, to those poor people, to give up hope. We just keep prodding there, we keep complaining. And at the end, at one point, we said, look, we need to give our people COVID support. We need to do some humanitarian support to these people. We have to go in, you know, allow us to take the food items and COVID support materials, you know.
Yeah, that reminds me of another Mary Robinson quote. We're big fans, Joseph, big fans. But she's, you know, she uses the term prisoners of hope. And that definitely sounds like something that you, and a mantra that you are kind of bringing through your organization. And I, for one, think you're extremely brave and you've got such a resilient attitude. I think it's great. But just to ask you one particular question from our side, we've been asking all of our guests this question this season, and it's, what three things would you like to see happen in the next decade to create real change in order to benefit our environment? And this can be on a local or a global scale.
First, let me look at it from the global scale, global perspective. And I think I started it a while ago when I said the northern countries' footprint is so huge on southern countries from consumption. Our consumption pattern is so awful, so bad, that we waste food that is needed by millions of people in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
You know, we waste practically everything in the northern countries, to the extent that, you know, those who could benefit may not benefit, are not benefiting. So the footprint of northern countries is really huge in terms of consumption, minerals, oil and gas, forest products, food, everything. The consumption is so huge in the north that we in the south are suffering. So if we can only change our pattern of consumption, if we can reduce it by 50%, I'm sure we'll save the world 50% in terms of climate change, because our demand will become so less in such a way that demand on natural resources all over the world will become less. And then life forms will regenerate. But it seems as if our consumption pattern is ever increasing. Even after COVID, we thought that COVID may have brought in a lease of life and the lockdowns will save the planet. It was even during the COVID time that Brazil was chopping their forests to such a proportion, you know. And then you ask yourself, so what is COVID doing then? In any case, northern countries may want to rethink their consumption.
Absolutely.
For us in the south, we are now being seen as the providers of natural resources for the north. And when that happens, you have a lot of problems like corruption, bad governance. And when corruption sets in, supporting, for instance, big businesses in either the extractive sector or the food production sector, then we are going to lose even the natural resources at such a rate that the countries suffer. And we as people will definitely suffer at the end of the day. So, in Africa or in parts of the world where corruption is rife, it will lead to the consumption, the grave consumption of natural resources. Bad governance, nobody cares about the rights of people, nobody cares about democracy. So once that happens, it is going to impact on natural resource governance as well. Politicking in Africa, I'm sorry, in our own part of the world, is also very important, because politics touches everything. And politics raises conflicts in our own situations. So for southern countries, and when you see it, politics is an issue, and those issues of political businesses lead to conflicts. Sometimes even war. I mean, we've seen where Sudan and countries like that are faced with big time wars, you know. Corruption will definitely lead to the uneven consumption of natural resources, and we suppress people who are really the legitimate owners of natural resources to suffer. So those are the issues I will throw in into the whole thing. But you also have this culture. I've not been able to articulate it very well yet, but I think culture is also something that we should understand. Because when northern businesses come into the southern areas, they learn less about the cultures of people. Equally so, the southern people understand less of the cultures from where the business people are coming from. And so the culture crashes. When there's a crash of culture, there's going to be problems. And those problems lead definitely to issues of conflicts and issues of rights violation. So I would throw four things in, as the case may be, for the world or for us to ponder over them. Because climate change is man-made. It is man-made. If we stop our consumption, we are going to save the world. We will save climate. We will bring back the climate perhaps to a level where the globe will manage it. And diseases such as the current pandemic, COVID, Ebola, and those things are likely going to be controlled naturally. The natural systems created by nature. But as long as there is this imbalance in nature, where the environmental services are no longer coping the natural settings of the world, then problems are going to be abound. Diseases will spring up, weather, freaky weather patterns will be there, and many other problems we emanate.
Well, Joseph, thank you so much for your time. I mean, we could probably stay here all day with you and Mariam, but we really appreciate you sharing your story and everything you're doing with Green Scenery. We will share everything that people will need to contact you online. And yeah, we really want to say thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. That was brilliant.
But I think I should really thank you for exposing us to the bigger audience out there, because our work is being done in a small corner, thanks to Mariam, who are also helping us reach other sectors. And for you, Climate Queens, I'm sure you have a very big and wide network in which our stories will be told. But for that, I mean, we will only be heard perhaps in Sierra Leone, and for those friends who are good enough to talk about our work in other places. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We're absolutely honored to be able to share your story.
For more voices and perspectives of human rights defenders from around the world, tune into the Frontline Defenders podcast, Rights on the Line. You can find the podcast on many platforms, including Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts. Learn more by going to frontlinedefenders.org/podcast. You can also follow them on Frontline Defenders on Instagram and Facebook, and also Frontline HRD on Twitter.
Thank you all for listening. Please like and subscribe and share this episode far and wide, because remember, that in itself is climate action. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Bye.